Good evening, everyone. I guess let's begin. Hopefully others will be able to join doing prayer and opening song. So, who would like to offer opening prayer?
Well, Heavenly Father in heaven, we ask for your blessing to be with us this evening as Michael goes through the book Daniel Revelation. Help us to learn something that will help us and that we'll be able to share it with somebody else. And while we're doing this, prepare us for the latter rain. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Good evening again, everyone. So this week we're continuing in the beginning of Daniel 11. We started last time and I think we got as far as Alexander the Great. So we gotta start, but we've got a decent amount still to cover. Daniel 11 is the most detailed of all of Daniel's prophecies and the longest as well because it is so detailed. So it's gonna take us several weeks to get through, possibly even over a month. We'll see how things turn out. So before we begin, we have a couple of introductory quotes. This is one from E.G. White, Letter 253, 1889. And while talking about Daniel Revelation by Uriah Smith, Ellen White says, I consider that that book, Thoughts on Daniel and the Revelation, should go everywhere. It has its place and will do a grand, good work. So this is one of the books by Uriah, one of the books of all the pioneers she recommends the most. Out of all of them, this is the one she most highly recommends, the one we've been going over in these meetings, and this is why we've been covering it in these meetings, because it's the book she so highly recommends and lays out so clearly the prophecies. You notice that Ellen White's writings she never goes over all the prophecy of Daniel and Revelation herself. There are quite a few prophecies that she never covers, like the first four trumpets, the seven seals, even some of the churches, and quite a bit of Daniel. She does not ever explain personally. She only explains certain portions that were relevant, such as in the Great Controversy. And so because of that, whenever she's talking about the prophecies, whenever she wants you to go study the prophecies, the places she's not explained, she refers you to this book by Uriah Smith as a source on prophecy for those things that she does not herself explain, basically. And so out of all the books, it's the one she recommends the most, besides her own writings, like the Great Controversy and Desire of Ages, she recommends those as well, equally with it. So let's continue. And this is Principle 13 of Miller. We've been trying to go over these principles to help us memorize them and use them. So William Miller in his 13th principle says, "To know whether we have a true historical event for the fulfillment of a prophecy, if you find every word of the prophecy after the figures are understood is literally fulfilled, then you may know that your history is the true event. But if one word lacks a fulfillment, then you must look for another event or wait its future development. For God takes care that history and prophecy doth agree, so that the true believing children of God may never be ashamed." And these are his proofs. Psalm 22, verse 5. "They cried unto thee, and were delivered. They trusted in thee, and were not confounded." Isaiah 45, verses 17 through 19. "But Israel shall be saved in the Lord with an everlasting salvation. They shall not be ashamed nor confounded, world without end. For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He hath established it. He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else. I have not spoken in secret in a dark place of the earth. I said not unto the seed of Jacob, seek me in vain. I, the Lord, speak righteousness. I declare things that are right." 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 6. "Wherefore it is also contained in the Scripture, behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he that believeth on him shall not be confounded. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast, that the words of God shall be fulfilled." I'll make a comment on this verse, and what Miller is applying this verse to is how these nations that are in prophecy, basically by Revelation 17, God is saying that he will put into their hearts to fulfill the prophecy. And so, no nation, if it's in prophecy, can violate what God said that nation will do. God will make sure of it. And you look at this with Alexander the Great. There's some very interesting history with him where there was one particular person that possibly could have stopped Alexander the Great. And what happened to him? He died of sickness. And so God makes sure that these prophecies are fulfilled. Acts chapter 3, verse 18. "But those things which God before had sowed by the mouth of all his prophets, that Christ should suffer, he hath so fulfilled." And so those are his proof texts. So now we're ready to continue where we left off at. In chapter 11, continuing with verse 5. And Mom, would you like to take it from here?
Yes. Good evening, everyone. We are going to continue with the book Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith. This is published by the Southern Publishing Association in 1897. Chapter 11, A Literal Prophecy. And we are continuing with verse 5. This is probably my favorite prophecy of Daniel. It's not in symbols. It's in plain language. And it covers a lot. And last week we discussed how the chapter 11 prophecy is really a continued in-depth explanation of the prophecy of the ram and he-goat in Daniel chapter 8. So this is just a further explanation of it in plain language and in more detail than most other prophecies of the Bible, and without using symbols, which is unusual in Daniel and Revelation to have a prophecy with no symbols. Continuing, verse 5, "And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion." King of the north and the king of the south are many times referred to in the remaining portion of this chapter. It therefore becomes essential to an understanding of the prophecy clearly to identify these powers. When Alexander's empire was divided, the different portions lay toward the four winds of heaven, west, north, east, and south. These divisions, of course, to be reckoned from the standpoint of Palestine, the native land of the prophet. That division of the empire lying west of Palestine would thus constitute the kingdom of the west, that lying north, the kingdom of the north, that lying east, the kingdom of the east, and that lying south, the kingdom of the south. The divisions of Alexander's kingdom with respect to Palestine were situated as follows. Cassander had Greece and the adjacent countries, which lay to the west. Lysimachus had Thrace, which then included Asia Minor, and the countries lying on the Hellespont and Bosphorus, which lay to the north of Palestine. Seleucus had Syria and Babylon, which lay principally to the east, and Ptolemy had Egypt and the neighboring countries, which lay to the south. And I would like you to put up the map, Michael, of the four divisions so we have it clear in mind what we're talking about here, because I find it often very confusing to just read it.
Okay. So here's a map of the division of four after Alexander's death. So we have Israel being about here where my mouse is. This is the land of Israel, Daniel's homeland. And so north, we have the land of Turkey, or Asia Minor, as it's often called. And this was ruled by Lysimachus. To the east, we have Seleucus in yellow. To the south, we have Egypt in blue. And to the west, we have Cassander in purple, ruling mainland Greece. So these were the four generals in their division after Alexander's death.
And this is what it resolved to after about, what is it, 20 years or was it 40 years of fighting?
It was 20 years. 40 years is when they end the Diadochi Wars.
Okay. But after about 20 years, this is what it looked like. So with that in mind, we will continue with the description here. During the wars and revolutions, which for long ages succeeded these geographical boundaries, were frequently changed or obliterated. Old ones were wiped out and new ones instituted. But whatever changes might occur, these first divisions of the empire must determine the names which these portions of territory should ever afterward bear, or we have no standard by which to test the application of the prophecy. That is, whatever power at any time should occupy the territory which at first constituted the kingdom of the north, that power, so long as it occupied that territory, would be the king of the north. And whatever power should occupy that which at first constituted the kingdom of the south, that power would so long be the king of the south. And this is important because this prophecy spans a period of time larger than 2,000 years. So this is a very, very vast period of time, and lots of political changes occur during this period of time. So the beginning here is where we establish where these powers are.
I'd like to make a comment on that.
Go ahead.
So we mentioned last time how this prophecy is literal according to the angel, because the angel tells him in verse 2, that now I will show you the truth. Not that what had already been given to Daniel wasn't truth. What he'd been given to Daniel before was truth, but it was full of symbols. Here, especially with the nations of Daniel 11, they're not using symbols. Instead, they're describing the characteristics of the nation. So when it says king of the north, king of the south, it is literally describing the characteristics of the nation. It's not a symbol. Instead, it is literally the king of the north, the king of the south. And thus, we base it off a division of Alexander's empire. And that's why the angel says, now I'm going to tell you the truth, because we're going to describe this, especially the nations, not so much in symbols, instead in literal language.
We speak of only these two, the north and the south, because they are the only ones afterward spoken of in the prophecy. And because, in fact, almost the whole of Alexander's empire finally resolved itself into these two divisions. Most of the east got incorporated into the king of the north. And there were some small territories in the west that never really became part of the king of the north. But the principal ones were king of the north, king of the south. Seleucus ended up gaining the territory of the king of the north, but then he lost a good share of the territory to the east, to the Parthians, and that comes up later when we discuss the trumpets. Cassander was very soon conquered by Lysimachus, and his kingdom, Greece and Macedon, annexed to Thrace. And Lysimachus was in turn conquered by Seleucus, and Macedon and Thrace annexed to Syria. These facts prepare the way for an application of the text before us. The king of the south, Egypt, shall be strong. Ptolemy annexed Cyprus, Phoenicia, Caria, Cyrene, and many islands and cities to Egypt. Thus was his kingdom made strong. But another of Alexander's princes is introduced in the expression, one of his princes. The Septuagint translates the verse thus, and the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his, Alexander's, princes shall be strong above him. This must refer to Seleucus, who has already stated, having annexed Macedon and Thrace to Syria, thus became possessor of three parts out of four of Alexander's dominion, and established a more powerful kingdom than that of Egypt. Now, what happened when the death of Alexander occurred is Ptolemy immediately headed for Egypt. And it had been planned that Alexander's son, when he was born, be taken back to Greece and the kingdom be ruled under a regency until he became of age to rule. Of course, that did not happen. The regent was killed and these generals started fighting amongst each other, and ultimately all of Alexander's relatives were killed by the time you get to the four divisions. But one thing that Ptolemy did was he managed to take Alexander's body. Now, it was intended that that be taken to Greece and that Alexander be buried in Greece where he came from. What happened was Ptolemy, through a subterfuge, managed to take Alexander's body to Egypt. And he embalmed it and put it on display in a mausoleum in Egypt. And for 300 years, you could go to Alexandria in Egypt and you could go into Alexander's mausoleum and you could see the body of Alexander embalmed, and people could go and visit him. Somewhere during the time of Rome, his body vanished and nobody knows what happened to it. But this is one of the ways in which Ptolemy made himself strong. He got Alexander's body. And so with that there, he could claim that he was the rightful heir of all of the kingdom of Alexander, even though he only had the king of the south. And all the way through this history of Greece, you find Ptolemy and his descendants, the Ptolemies of Egypt, to be quite strong. And this is actually the last period in ancient history that Egypt ever was strong. After this, ancient Egypt ceases to exist, and Egypt is never again a very strong power. So we have here the king of the south is strong. And definitely in history, Ptolemy was strong. But then another of his princes, Alexander's princes, was strong above him. And you see this with Seleucus coming in and taking over this whole three quarters, pretty much, of Alexander's kingdom and getting the full territory of the king of the north. Verse 6.
Do we want to show the map here of Ptolemy and Seleucus?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay.
Much easier to understand with the maps than just trying to get it from the text.
All right, so let me pull this up. Which so this map illustrates how Seleucus became the king of the north. So, at first, Seleucus was the king of the east. He ruled the eastern part of Alexander's empire. But then he conquered Lysimachus, the king of the north. And so he became ruler of this territory north of Israel. And then Ptolemy, of course, as the prophecy says, grew strong. We can see that Ptolemy has gained decent amounts of territory. Lots of reasons why Ptolemy became strong. But Seleucus became stronger. One of the other of Alexander's princes became stronger above him. Because Seleucus got two divisions. And for a very brief period of time, Seleucus also may have had the Western division. However, he was assassinated about the same time he gained that territory, so never really actually gained any control of it, and his sons never held on to it. They just went back and they just held the central areas of the King of the North and the King of the East. So the king of the west remains independent, which actually comes up in the prophecy. He is indirectly mentioned later in the prophecy, so that comes up later. So this is a division with Seleucus in the north and Ptolemy in the south. And for the next, I think we're on verse, ready for verse 6 now. So for the next 10 verses, these two nations, Seleucus and Ptolemy, are the subject for the most part. Rome is brought in near the end. And this is what Rome controlled this time.
Verse 6, and in the end of years, they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement that she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm. But she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her, in these times. There were frequent wars between the kings of Egypt and Syria, especially was this the case with Ptolemy Philadelphus, the second king of Egypt, and Antiochus Theos, the third king of Syria. They at length agreed to make peace upon condition that Antiochus Theos should put away his former wife Laodice and her two sons, and should marry Berenice, the daughter of Ptolemy Philadelphus. Ptolemy accordingly brought his daughter to Antiochus, bestowing with her an immense dowry. So this was supposed to unite these two warring kingdoms, but didn't actually work. Greece loved nothing better than fighting civil war. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, that is, her interest in power with Antiochus. And so it proved, for some time shortly after, in a fit of love, Antiochus brought back his former wife, Laodice, and her children to court again. Then says the prophecy, neither shall he, Antiochus, stand nor his arm or seed. Laodice, being restored to favor and power, feared lest in the fickleness of his temper Antiochus should again disgrace her and recall Berenice, and conceiving that nothing short of his death would be an effectual safeguard against such a contingency, she caused him to be poisoned shortly after. Neither did his seed by Berenice succeed him in the kingdom, for Laodice so managed affairs as to secure the throne for her eldest son, Seleucus Callinicus. And this is how it didn't work. They're trying to unite, and it all fell apart. But such wickedness could not long remain unpunished, as the prophecy further predicts and further history proves. Verse 7, but out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against him, and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom, and shall return into his own land. The whole expedition done by the king of the south into the land of the king of the north. This branch out of the same root with Berenice was her brother, Ptolemy Euergetes. He had no sooner succeeded his father, Ptolemy Philadelphus, in the kingdom of Egypt than, burning to avenge the death of his sister, Berenice, he raised an immense army and invaded the territory of the king of the north, that is, of Seleucus Callinicus, who with his mother, Laodice, had reigned in Syria. And what he didn't say was they had not only murdered his father, but also Berenice and those who came with her, so that there wouldn't be any claimant to the throne. And he prevailed against them, even to the conquering of Syria, Cilicia, the upper parts beyond the Euphrates, and almost all of Asia. So he overran Seleucus's kingdom. But hearing that a sedition was raised in Egypt requiring his return home, he plundered the kingdom of Seleucus, took 40,000 talents of silver and precious vessels, and 2,500 images of the gods. Among these were the images which Cambyses had formerly taken from Egypt and carried into Persia. The Egyptians, being wholly given to idolatry, bestowed upon Ptolemy the title of Euergetes, or the benefactor, as a compliment for his having thus, after many years, restored their captive gods. This is a very brief summary of what happened. See, the Persians were not idolaters in the sense that the Egyptians were. The Persians worshipped a single god. It was the god of fire. And they didn't worship this god with graven images. So when the Persians came into Egypt, they considered the Egyptians to be a backwards race with all of their gods and images that they worshipped. And they systematically plundered the temples of Egypt and took thousands of these images away into Persia, not to worship them, but because they were works of art, and they considered them not to be sacred. Whereas prior to this, you didn't go do this to the gods of another nation because images were sacred. Well, the Persians said they're not sacred. For this reason, the Egyptians hated the Persians. They really, really did not like the Persians. And so when the Greeks came and they worshipped the Egyptian gods, and Alexander claimed that he was the descendant of one of the Egyptian gods, and the Egyptians proclaimed him to be a god, and Alexander really took to that and said, yes, yes, I am a god. And this was one reason why he rejected the worship of the true God at the temple in Israel when it was presented to him, is because he really loved the acclamations that the Egyptians gave him of being a god himself. Now, in Greek culture, in Greek literature, the king was not considered to be a god. In Roman, later on, they did, but in the Greeks, they didn't really consider the king to be a god. So a living person wasn't considered to be a god, but Egypt said Alexander was, and Alexander really liked this, and so he said, yes, yes, I'm a god. And so the Egyptians really loved the Greeks. So now Ptolemy Euergetes goes, and he gets thousands, I think they said it was like 2,500, of these images that the Persians had plundered from the Egyptians and been holding in Persia, and he brings them back to Egypt. And the priests are thrilled. The Egyptians absolutely love him. because he's done this. And an interesting side note about this, if anybody has heard of the Rosetta Stone, this was discovered, this is a stone that was discovered when the French invaded Egypt in 1798. And it was partially buried. They uncovered it. And this stone had an inscription on it in three different scripts. The first script was the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. The second script was the simplified, much later Egyptian writing of the time of Ptolemy's. The third inscription was in classical Greek of the time of the Ptolemies. When this was discovered in 1798, they had completely lost the ability to read both the Egyptian hieroglyphs and the simplified Egyptian script of ancient Egypt from the time of the Greeks. But they still knew how to read the ancient Greek script. So they took this stone, ultimately England ended up with it, and still has it, by the way, in England. They took this stone, and they were able to, utilizing this inscription, determine the meaning of the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. And using that is how they've been able to learn how to read ancient Egyptian scripts on ancient Egyptian monuments. The ancient Egyptians loved to write extensively on their monuments and their tombs. And so because of this stone, they've been able to decipher and understand the hieroglyphs. Now, what's really interesting is this Rosetta Stone is actually a monument that was set up in front of one of the temples in Egypt with the inscription on it praising Ptolemy Hieroglyphs for bringing the images back from Persia. So this very incident here in Daniel chapter 11, and it's talking about these gods being brought back, that generated the creation of a monument that has been very, very significant in modern scientific research and learning on ancient Egypt. So it's just an interesting little connection of events here that come together, and here it is right here in Daniel 11 about them actually bringing these images back to Egypt, and the Egyptians were very, very grateful for this, and for this reason they absolutely loved the Greeks. This, according to Bishop Newton, is Jerome's account extracted from ancient historians, but there are authors still extant, he says, who confirm several of the same particulars. Appian informs us that Laodice, having killed Antiochus, and after him both Berenice and her child Ptolemy, the son of Philadelphus, to revenge those murders, invaded Syria, slew Laodice, and proceeded as far as Babylon. From Polybius we learn that Ptolemy, surnamed Hieroglyphs, being greatly incensed at the cruel treatment of his sister Berenice, marched with an army into Syria and took the city of Seleucia, which was kept for some years afterward by garrisons of the kings of Egypt. Thus did he enter into the fortress of the king of the north. Polyanus affirms that Ptolemy made himself master of all the countries, from Mount Taurus as far as to India, without war or battle, but he ascribes it by mistake to the father instead of the son. Justin asserts that if Ptolemy had not been recalled into Egypt by a domestic sedition, he would have possessed the whole kingdom of Seleucus. The king of the south thus came into the dominion of the king of the north and returned to his own land, as the prophet had foretold. And he also continued more years than the king of the north, for Seleucus Callinicus died in exile of a fall from his horse, and Ptolemy Hieroglyphs survived him for 4 or 5 years. In verse 10, but his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overthrow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. The first part of this verse speaks of sons in the plural, the last part of one in the singular. The sons of Seleucus Callinicus were Seleucus, Serranus, and Antiochus Magnus. These both entered with zeal upon the work of vindicating and avenging the cause of their father and their country. The elder of these, Seleucus, first took the throne. He assembled a great multitude to recover his father's dominions. But being a weak and pusillanimous prince, both in body and estate, destitute of money and unable to keep his army in obedience, he was poisoned by two of his generals after an inglorious reign of 2 or 3 years. His more capable brother, Antiochus Magnus, was thereupon proclaimed king, who, taking charge of the army, retook Seleucia and recovered Syria, making himself master of some places by treaty and of others by force of arms. A truce followed wherein both sides treated for peace, yet prepared for war, after which Antiochus returned and overcame in battle Nicholas, the Egyptian general, and had thoughts of invading Egypt itself. Here is the one who should certainly overflow and pass through. Verse 11. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, that's anger. We saw this in chapter 8 where the goat was moved with choler against the ram. And shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. Ptolemy Philopater succeeded his father Euergetes in the kingdom of Egypt, being advanced to the crown not long after Antiochus Magnus had succeeded his brother in the government of Syria. He was a most luxurious and vicious prince, but was at length aroused at the prospect of an invasion of Egypt by Antiochus. He was indeed moved with choler for the losses he had sustained and the danger which threatened him, and he came forth out of Egypt with a numerous army to check the progress of the Syrian king. The king of the north was also to set forth a great multitude. The army of Antiochus, according to Polybius, amounted on this occasion to 62,000 foot, 6,000 horse, and 102 elephants. In the battle, Antiochus was defeated, and his army, according to prophecy, was given into the hands of the king of the south. 10,000 foot and 3,000 horse were slain, and over 4,000 men were taken prisoners, while of Ptolemy's army there were slain only 700 horse and about twice that number of infantry. Verse 12, and when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. Ptolemy lacked the prudence to make a good use of his victory. Had he followed up his success, he would probably have become master of the whole kingdom of Antiochus. But, content with making only a few menaces and a few threats, he made peace that he might be able to give himself up to the uninterrupted and uncontrolled indulgence of his brutish passions. Thus, having conquered his enemies, he was overcome by his vices, and forgetful of the great name which he might have established, he spent his time in feasting and lewdness. His heart was lifted up by his success, but he was far from being strengthened by it, for the inglorious use he made of it caused his own subjects to rebel against him. But the lifting up of his heart was more especially manifested in his transactions with the Jews. Coming to Jerusalem, he there offered sacrifices and was very desirous of entering into the most holy place of the temple, contrary to the law and religion of that place. But being, though with great difficulty, restrained, he left the place, burning with anger against the whole nation of the Jews, and immediately commenced against them a terrible and relentless persecution. In Alexandria, where the Jews had resided since the days of Alexander, and enjoyed the privileges of the most favored citizens, 40,000, according to Eusebius, 60,000, according to Jerome, were slain in this persecution. The rebellion of the Egyptians and the massacre of the Jews certainly were not calculated to strengthen him and his kingdom, but were sufficient, rather almost totally, to ruin it. Remember, at the very beginning of our presentations, I talked about the authorship of the Septuagint and how it was commissioned by Ptolemy II as part of his investment in the library in Alexandria. And an interesting thing with if all of this back and forth between King of the South, King of the North, Jerusalem's right in the middle. And so it's changing hands constantly. King of the South owns it, then the King of the North has it, then the King of the South, and back and forth and back and forth. And a lot of the Jews were actually in the armies of the Greeks as slaves. The Greeks would enslave them and use them as soldiers in their armies. So there were actually quite a few Jews fighting in the armies of Ptolemy, also in the armies of Seleucus as slaves. And this is how, at first, you end up with so many Jews in Egypt, is a lot of them ended up there because they'd been enslaved by the Greeks as mercenaries in the army and ended up serving Ptolemy and being in Egypt and then ultimately stayed there. So you have lots and lots of Jews down in Egypt in particular. But they're also scattered because you had all the Jews in Persia who hadn't returned to Jerusalem. They became subject to the king of the north, to Seleucus and eventually Antiochus. And they basically got spread out all over the whole Greek Empire, as well as concentrated in the area of Jerusalem and Judea. Verse 13, for the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and much riches. So this continues, this back and forth between north and south. The events predicted in this verse were to occur after certain years. The peace concluded between Ptolemy Philopater and Antiochus lasted for 14 years. Meanwhile, Ptolemy died from intemperance and debauchery and was succeeded by his son, Ptolemy Epiphanes, a child then 4 or 5 years old. Antiochus, during this time, having suppressed rebellion in his kingdom and reduced and settled the eastern parts in their obedience, was at leisure for any enterprise when young Epiphanes came to the throne of Egypt. And thinking this too good an opportunity for enlarging his dominion to be let slip, he raised an immense army greater than the former, for he had collected many forces and acquired great riches in his eastern expedition, and set out against Egypt, expecting to have an easy victory over the infant king. How he succeeded, we shall presently see, for here new complications enter into the affairs of these kingdoms, and new actors are introduced upon the stage of history. This is where things start to change. Verse 14. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fall. This is where we see Rome for the first time. In Daniel chapter 11. Antiochus was not the only one who rose up against the infant Ptolemy. Agathocles, his prime minister, having possession of the king's person and conducting the affairs of the kingdom in his stead, was so dissolute and proud in the exercise of his power that the provinces which before were subject to Egypt rebelled. Egypt itself was disturbed by seditions, and the Alexandrians rising up against Agathocles caused him, his sister, his mother, and their associates to be put to death. At the same time, Philip, king of Macedon, entered into a league with Antiochus to divide the dominions of Ptolemy between them, each proposing to take the parts which lay nearest and most convenient to him. Here was a rising up against the king of the south sufficient to fulfill the prophecy and the very events beyond doubt which the prophecy intended. A new power is now introduced. The robbers of thy people. Literally, says Bishop Newton, the breakers of thy people. For away on the banks of the Tiber, a kingdom had been nourishing itself with ambitious projects and dark designs. Small and weak at first, it grew with marvelous rapidity in strength and vigor, reaching out cautiously here and there to try its prowess and test the vigor of its warlike arm, till conscious of its power, it boldly reared its head among the nations of the earth and seized with invincible hand the helm of their affairs. Henceforth, the name of Rome stands upon the historic page, destined for long ages to control the affairs of the world and exert a mighty influence among the nations, even to the end of time. And I wanted to make a comment here that Rome introduced here is not introduced as the King of the North. We already have a King of the North in Antiochus and a King of the South in Ptolemy. Rome is a third party. And it's been said many times that Rome is the King of the North when it is introduced into the prophecy. Well, here it's introduced into the prophecy, but it is not introduced as the King of the North. I want to make that very clear. Rome is never once in the prophecy referred to as the King of the North. Rome spoke, and Syria and Macedonia soon found a change coming over the aspect of their dream. The Romans interfered in behalf of the young king of Egypt, determined that he should be protected from the ruin devised by Antiochus and Philip. This was B.C. 200 and was one of the first important interferences of the Romans in the affairs of Syria and Egypt. Roland furnishes the following succinct account of this matter. The other thing I wanted to point out here very clearly, when Rome appears on the scene, whose side are they on? They are not on the side of the King of the North. They are showing up on the side of the King of the South. So if Rome is to be the King of the North, why did they start out on the South? So if Rome is going to become the king, which it is in first allied with, then technically Rome should be considered the King of the South. But Rome isn't either. Rome is a third party coming in and interfering with the kings of the North and the South. Antiochus, king of Syria, and Philip, king of Macedonia, during the reign of Ptolemy Philopater, had discovered the strongest zeal for the interests of that monarch and were ready to assist him on all occasions. Yet no sooner was he dead, leaving behind him an infant, whom the laws of humanity and justice enjoined them not to disturb in the possession of his father's kingdom, then they immediately joined in a criminal alliance and excited each other to shake off the lawful heir and divide his dominions between them. Philip was to have Caria, Libya, Cyrenaica, and Egypt, and Antiochus all the rest. With this view, the latter entered Coel, Syria, and Palestine, and in less than two campaigns made an entire conquest of the two provinces, with all their cities and dependencies. Their guilt, says Polybius, would not have been quite so glaring had they, like tyrants, endeavored to gloss over their crimes with some specious pretense, but, so far from doing this, their injustice and cruelty were so barefaced that to them was applied what is generally said of fishes, that the larger ones, though of the same species, prey on the lesser. One would be tempted, continues the same author, at seeing the most sacred laws of society so openly violated, to accuse Providence of being indifferent and insensible to the most horrid crimes. But it fully justified its conduct by punishing those two kings according to their deserts, and made such an example of them as ought in all succeeding ages to deter others from following their example. For while they were meditating to dispossess a weak and helpless infant of his kingdom by piecemeal, Providence raised up the Romans against them, who entirely subverted the kingdoms of Philip and Antiochus and reduced their successors to almost as great calamities as those with which they intended to crush the infant king. And this is a quote from Ancient History, Book 18, Chapter 50. to establish the vision. The Romans being more prominently than any other people the subject of Daniel's prophecy, their first interference in the affairs of these kingdoms is here referred to as being the establishment or demonstration of the truth of the vision which predicted the existence of such a power. But they shall fall. Some refer this to those mentioned in the first part of the verse who should stand up against the king of the south. Others to the robbers of Daniel's people, the Romans. It is true in either case. If those who combined against Ptolemy are referred to, all that need be said is that they did speedily fall. And if it applies to the Romans, the prophecy simply looked forward to the period of their overthrow, which was hundreds of years later. Verse 15. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities.
Do you want to bring in the map here of this?
Yes, let's do that.
I have a map of that. All right, so this is a map of the introduction in verse 14 of the robbers of thy people and many standing up against the king of the south. What happened here? Just a second, sorry. Having technical difficulty? Alright. There we go. Alright, this is the map. So we can see Seleucus in the north, Ptolemy in the south, and the vision says that many stand up against the king of the south, or Ptolemy, and Seleucus, his empire, which at this time was ruled by Antiochus. So we have Antiochus standing up against them. Philip, that is mentioned, was the king of Macedon, so purple here. So that was the second king standing up against the king of the south, and then plus king of the south had a rebellion going on. So that's three people standing up against Ptolemy. Then it says Rome is going to stand up at the robbers of that people, and this is what Rome looked like in 200 BC. And although on this map they may have less land than Seleucus, they were, at this point, became more powerful. They would defeat Seleucus just after this, basically in defense of the king of the south. Part of the involvement in defense of the king of the south would be them defeating Seleucus in Turkey. And they would crush Macedon in three different wars. In the third war, they finally just took the territory. In the first two wars, they let Philip keep his throne. But the third one, they conquered Macedon. So this is the Romans beginning to interfere in Greek affairs, and already at this point, its army was proving its prowess in defeating the Greek allies, and so they weren't able to entirely fend off the Romans. The Ptolemy would survive. In fact, out of all the divisions, Ptolemy would be the last one to go because of the Roman support given to them.
So at this point, I ask the question, because it has been said multiple times that Rome becomes the king of the north when they conquer the king of the north, because this was the first territory they conquered. I ask the question, was Rome the king of the north or was Rome the king of the south? Because the reason they conquered the king of the north was to support the claims of the king of the south. So which king were they? The answer, of course, is they were neither. They were Rome. And Rome is not the king of the north. Rome is not the king of the south. Ultimately, they're going to control all of this territory. And during the period of time where they control all of this territory, we don't hear anything at all in the prophecy about king of the north or king of the south. So you just keep this in mind as you're reading through this prophecy, because this is the point where a lot of people try to explain this prophecy and start bringing in a lot of confusing ideas. And the prophecy doesn't need to be confusing. It's in plain language. It's very simple. But you have to keep straight what we're talking about and what's being presented. And this is why we've done the maps, because the maps really help to solidify what's being talked about and where things are located. Verse 15. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. The tuition of the young king of Egypt was entrusted by the Roman Senate to M. Aemilius Lepidus, who appointed Aristomenes, an old and experienced minister of that court, his guardian. His first act was to provide against the threatened invasion of the two confederated kings, Philip and Antiochus. To this end, he dispatched Scopas, a famous general of Aetolia, then in the service of the Egyptians, into his native country to raise reinforcements for the army. Having equipped an army, he marched into Palestine and Coele Syria, Antiochus being engaged in a war with Attalus in Lesser Asia, and reduced all Judea into subjection to the authority of Egypt. Thus affairs were brought into a posture for the fulfillment of the verse before us. For Antiochus, desisting from his war with Attalus at the dictation of the Romans, took speedy steps for the recovery of Palestine and Coele Syria from the hands of the Egyptians. Scopas was sent to oppose him. Near the sources of the Jordan, the two armies met. Scopas was defeated, pursued to Sidon, and there closely besieged. Three of the ablest generals of Egypt, with their best forces, were sent to raise the siege, but without success. At length, Scopas meeting in the gaunt and intangible specter of famine, a foe with whom he was unable to cope, was forced to surrender on the dishonorable terms of life only, whereupon he and his 10,000 men were suffered to depart, stripped and naked. Here was the taking of the most fenced cities by the king of the north. For Sidon was, both in its situation and its defenses, one of the strongest cities of those times. Here was the failure of the arms of the south to withstand, and the failure also of the people which the king of the south had chosen, namely, Scopas and his Aetolian forces. Verse 16. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. And I wanted to make the comment here that it's during these verses that we've been discussing, King of the North, King of the South, back and forth, robbers of thy people, all of this going on, that the occurrence of Antiochus Epiphanes coming to Jerusalem and stopping the sacrifices for just over 3 years and offering a pig on the altar, which was grievously offensive to God and to the Jews, occurred. And the reason I bring that incident in here is because that is the incident that is used by the majority of the Christian world and even by some Adventists as the actual fulfillment of the 2300 days of Daniel 8:14. Doesn't fit when you understand that what we're reading here in chapter 11 is a further explanation of Daniel 8. And there's no specific mention of Antiochus Epiphanes here and these events. You would think it's so much importance is put on the 2300 days and the taking away of the daily in Daniel 8:14, you would think it would have a mention in here. You would think it would be emphasized, and it's not. We're all the way down here now. We're getting into the Romans, and we have not talked about this specific incident with Antiochus Epiphanes because it wasn't that big an issue. With all of these other things that were going on, it wasn't significant. And this right here puts the lie to that interpretation of the 2300 days. That doesn't work. That's a traditional interpretation that has been invented by the, originally by the Jews to avoid the interpretation of understanding of Jesus as the Messiah, and later by the Catholic Church to avoid the understanding of the papacy as being fulfilling these prophecies. And the idea, of course, behind this is all of Daniel was fulfilled before Christ. and Revelation is after Christ, of course. So they have to condense it all and try to have all of this happen before Christ, which really, really messes up the prophecy and doesn't really line up with what we have here. Although Egypt could not stand, let's see, did I even read the verse? Verse 16, but he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land which by his hand shall be consumed. Although Egypt could not stand before Antiochus, the king of the north, Antiochus could not stand before the Romans, who now came against him. No kingdoms were longer able to resist this rising power. Syria was conquered and added to the Roman Empire when Pompey, B.C. 65, deprived Antiochus Asiaticus of his possessions and reduced Syria to a Roman province. So now we have a change in power. I want you to notice that phrase, according to his will. We saw this when Alexander came in and took over Persia. We now see it again with Caesar and Rome. The same power was also to stand in the Holy Land and consume it. Rome became connected with the people of God, the Jews, by alliance, B.C. 168, from which date it holds a prominent place in the prophetic calendar. It did not, however, acquire jurisdiction over Judea by actual conquest till B.C. 63, and then in the following manner. And it's interesting when you look at the history of the Jews and how they were all wanting domination over the Romans. They actually became allies of the Romans in 162 because they saw the Romans as a way to protect them from these constant back and forth conflicts between the king of the north and the king of the south. We saw how the king of the south got angry with them because they wouldn't let him into the most holy place and slaughtered 40 or 60,000 Jews in Egypt as a result of that. And we also were talking about Antiochus Epiphanes and how he came and stopped the services in the sanctuary and offered a pig on the altar. And so they were back and forth, and the Jews said, okay, Rome's going to be able to protect us from these two. And they made an alliance with Rome in 162 B.C., and then later were conquered by Rome in 62 B.C. So this is some of the pictures of what's happening and why these things were the way they were when Christ came. And I see that our time is up, so I think we will come back to this next week and get into this description of just how Judea was conquered in 62 BC by Pompey.
Are we going to quit here?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Are we going to quit here?
That's what I was thinking. Do we want to continue?
We have a couple more slides and then we'll start on verse 17.
Okay. If everybody wants to continue and finish these two slides, I'm more than willing to do that.
Go ahead.
Pompey, not to be deceived in this way with impunity, put Aristobulus, whom he had retained with him in irons, and immediately marched against Jerusalem with his whole army. The partisans of Aristobulus were for defending the place, those of Hyrcanus for opening the gates. The latter being in the majority and prevailing, Pompey was given free entrance into the city. Whereupon the adherents of Aristobulus retired to the mountain of the temple as fully determined to defend that place as Pompey was to reduce it. At the end of 3 months, a breach was made in the wall sufficient for an assault, and the place was carried at the point of the sword. In the terrible slaughter that ensued, 12,000 persons were slain. It was an affecting sight, observes the historian, to see the priests engaged at the time in divine service, with calm hand and steady purpose, pursue their accustomed work, apparently unconscious of the wild tumult, though all around them their friends were given to the slaughter, and though often their own blood mingled with that of their sacrifices. So it's interesting here, this was happening in 62. And then you get down to Christ, and it talks about Herod having built the temple. And it talks about the temple was fairly new when Christ was here. The reality is the temple, the second temple, was partially destroyed and damaged by this conflict. And so Herod rebuilt it. So the actual building that was the second temple was still there, but Herod cleaned it up and he rebuilt it and he beautified it and he added porches and made it into a vast and beautiful complex that it had not been before. And this is why, and in some historians actually call the Temple of Christ Day the third temple, because this is what happened. You read here about how all of this fighting occurred. It was very much damaged and had to be rebuilt. And this is why when Christ was here, the Jews were very proud of their temple. They were very proud of what Herod had done to rebuild it after all of this had occurred. Having put an end to the war, Pompey demolished the walls of Jerusalem, transferred several cities from the jurisdiction of Judea to that of Syria, and imposed a tribute on the Jews. Thus, for the first time, was Jerusalem placed by conquest in the hands of that power which was to hold the glorious land in its iron grasp till it had utterly consumed it. And, of course, the Romans ultimately destroyed Jerusalem in 70 A.D., which was just over 100 years after this. It actually wasn't that long when you actually stop to consider it. Of course, in the middle of that, you had Christ's advent, you had his birth, and you had his ministry, and you had his death. So we focus a lot on that, and you had the beginning of the Christian church. But the reality is we have 62 BC to 70 AD, which is a little less than 200 years from the time Rome got control of Palestine and Jerusalem till they completely destroyed it. Now, of course, the walls were broken down by Pompey. Herod was heavily involved in rebuilding those so that when Christ was here, it was well fortified again. And the Romans had quite a bit of difficulty in completely destroying it, but ultimately they did. And so that brings us down to verse 17, which we will pick up with next time.
Do we want to really quick show the two maps for this verse 16?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay. So let me pull up the first one. I think that's it right there. All right. So the verse 16 starts out with Rome coming to defend the king of the south. And, of course, he conquers Macedon, which is one of the enemies of the king of the south. So Rome grows. And then Rome, after this, conquers Seleucus. And we can see they then gain Judea, the glorious land. And so at this point, 61 BC, every other division of Alexander's empire was gone, except for Egypt. And So this leaves us with Rome now as being the prominent part of the prophecy. And after this, we see Rome referenced again and again as him. With
and
Ptolemy.
Even at this time, Ptolemy was an ally of Rome.
Yes, Ptolemy remained
They weren't opposing
an ally of
Rome.
Ptolemy remained an ally of Rome until you get down to, which is also brought up in the prophecy, Antony, who was a Roman himself, who used Egypt in a rebellion against Augustus. And that, of course, is brought out in the prophecy. So, this is the map. We can see the Rome expanding. They conquer Macedon, Philip. Then they conquer Seleucus. And they conquer Judah. They stand in the glorious land. They conquered all of the land of Alexander's divisions, for the most part, other than Ptolemy. Now, the Parthians absorbed most of the East, and they're a separate nation, and they come up, or rather, the successors of the Parthians come up in the Seven Trumpets of Revelation, but that's a subject for another day. So I think that'll be a conclusion then for tonight. Who would like to offer a closing prayer?
Nobody else would like to, close with prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, Lord, I thank you for another day and for your watch care, Lord, over us. And I just pray for your leading in our lives and, Lord, to learn and to share it with others. And I pray that we may be a light and a blessing to those in this world. And we may give the loud cry of the third angel swells. The third message. And I just pray, Lord, for your presence, Lord, throughout the rest of this week. And you'll, Lord, to get through different challenges that each of us face. And I just thank you and praise you for all the brothers and sisters here and for the work that they're doing. And I pray this all, Lord, in your Son Jesus' holy and precious name. Amen.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody. Thanks again for the study, Michael, and enjoy the maps. They're very well done.